It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show, episode 210.
Interview with Sarah Lotz, horror, dread, and drive-through churches.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And obviously our special guest today is Sarah Lotz. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Oh, that was a brilliant tagline. I'm going to put it on the front of my book. I love it.
There you go.
It's a great little, like, you know, book tagline, I guess, you know, kind of. Also, this book is creepy. So
I was going to go with plane crashes and creepy children, but horror, dread, and drive-through churches also works.
So much better. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, because I always say, well, everyone says, what's the book about? And I say, it's about plane crashes and creepy children. And they like kind of then back away slowly. But that sounds like something they might want to read now. So cheers for that. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Generally, people don't want to subject themselves to creepy children on purpose, I think.
I think people do like creepy children. Like,
Village
or else, why is like The Exorcist, Village of the Damned, Children of the Corn, Damien, all of those things?
Do you think people like watching those, or do they watch them because they have like a deep seated like instinct to be scared out of their wits?
I think people like watching them.
Oh, okay, that's true, because I like The Exorcist a lot. That movie still scares the crap out of me.
And yet somehow you hate it when I do the demon voice.
Because it's creepy and I only want it in my fantasy space in a movie, but when a real person's doing it, I have to meet you face to face, Julia. I can't do it. Any case, we're here talking about your new book, The Three, which is currently out basically everywhere that books are sold, even on the moon, I hear.
Yes, that's correct. And even on Amazon, bizarrely, seeing as I'm a Hatchet author. See how quickly I put that in.
So I really wanted to start by getting you to talk a little bit about what was the basis for this work, because you've obviously written certain other kinds of works, such as The Mall with Louis Greenberg under the name S.L. Gray, which is a different kind of horror. And this one is, I would think it would be fair to say, much more international horror, if you would describe it as a horror. I would describe it as a horror, but that's because it's got creepy children. So, but if you could take a moment, maybe explain a little bit about sort of how this book came about.
Well, I've always been obsessed with plane crashes. And I mean really obsessed. Like, I think part of it is because I'm terrified of flying. So I really do, when I get on a plane, I get the sweaty palms and I feel nauseous and my life flashes before my eyes. And I do honestly believe that it will not stay in the air. And I've started, you know, they remember the air crash investigation shows. I don't know if they're still on, but they were in South Africa. They were just like back to back, and me and my husband were just completely glued to them. And I got quite obsessed. And so for years I need to write a book about a plane crash. And I wanted to write partly to sort of get to the root of why I was so scared of flying, and partly because, you know, I think it's a very common fear, sort of, because we all have to fly nowadays, you know, it pretty much whatever demographic you're from or income bracket you come from, at some stage in your life you will probably be getting on a plane. So I wanted to explore that sort of common dread of doing this, where you are actually getting into a metal tube and putting your life in someone else's hands, a complete stranger who you only hear their voice coming over an intercom. So that's basically where the story started. And then I thought, okay, so you want to write about a plane crash. Great. Well, how about two plane crashes? How about three? How about four? What would be an unthinkable event would be four plane crashes happening on the same day. And of course, the first thing that came to mind then was, I suppose, well, actually, it didn't really come to mind. It was really, I suppose, a subconscious thing was what happened after 9/11 was the, how this unthinkable, incredible, appalling event changed, you know, the way that we now, operate in a lot of ways. It sparked off wars. It sparked off, the war on terror. It's infiltrated politics. It's, it had a huge, massive global, sort of knock-on effect. So that was where it kind of grew from. Sorry, I went on a bit there.
Oh no, it's fine. It's fine. Paul, go ahead.
Right. Following up on that, I get the idea of a plane crash as being strong meaty matter, but why write this in such a, basically diving into looking at another book, the book within the book, Black Thursday? Why write it that way, Sarah? What was your impetus and inspiration for doing it that way?
It was written in the third person, and there was so much story because I was looking at the, first of all, the plane crashes take place on four different continents. There were three child survivors. There was also, a woman who was on one of the planes leaves a message behind, which then gets, picked up and starts spreading all kinds of rumors about the children, that they could possibly be the four horsemen of the apocalypse, et cetera, that the rapture's on its way. I had so much story and so many characters. And, to get this across, I needed in some kind of way, I needed to kind of boil it down. And I'm a massive fan of Max Brooks's World War Z and that kind of oral history approach. Was a big influence. And then I thought, well, that was an incredibly clever way that he had done, you know, looked at a sort of global sort of pandemic, a global apocalypse, and people were able to talk in their own way and in their own voices. And so that is where the idea came from. And then I'm also fascinated by how the media views plane crashes and how, you saw it with the Malaysian airline. It was everywhere, all over the news. And how we put a spin on an event and blow it up to such a great proportion. So having a book within a book, and the book is written by basically a tabloid journalist, she's going to have a bias as well on this whole story. Like the extracts that you get in the book within a book have all been edited by her. She's chosen all of them. She's spoken to who, you know, that there could be some that aren't in there. So there was another edge to the novel. That's what I was saying. Sorry.
No. Yeah, a very unreliable narrator. I appreciate that. As I was going through, it's like realizing she's not telling us everything. How much is she not telling us? It deepened and enriched the book for me. And I think Julia has a hand up, so I will shut up.
So, okay, I'm going to follow on that one in a second. But first, I just want to say, I read this book and I knew that my fiance would be going away on a plane journey soon, which he is coming back today. He's actually in the air right now.
Sorry.
And I was just reading this, and I'm not usually afraid of flying, and I walked into this book cold. I knew nothing about it. So I'm like, oh, it's a very, very, very clear personal description of a plane crash. This is terrifying. And now I'm terrified.
Well,
so well done on that front.
Thank you. But I mean, you do know that statistically
I do know statistically. Like I said, I'm not usually afraid of flying. I've been on small planes since I was a small child because my father used to fly them. And then, I've also done a lot of commercial flying. So like usually planes don't scare me. And the fact that you actually managed to do it in such a way that I was horrified was, I think that to me was the scariest part of the book. Like once we got into creepy children territory, I was like, okay, I can deal with this. We're not going to deal with more plane crashes now. It's over. So that was fascinating. But what I was actually going to ask you, instead of just telling you about how nightmarish that was, is I really did actually also pick up on the Max Brooks style. I was strongly reminded of World War Z while I was reading it, and I thought it was very neat the way you handled it. What I'm wondering is how you approached trying to cover so many different cultures, because you have the four plane crashes happen in four different parts of the world, and then you have to actually go, and even though these accounts are curated by the one tabloid journalist, they are supposedly in the voices of people in very different parts of the world. How did you approach that?
Basically, I at the beginning of the, when I started plotting out the novel and thinking about it, I didn't really give much thought to how much research I was going to do, which was incredibly stupid. So I was thinking, well, I definitely want to bring Khayelitsha into this book. Khayelitsha is the most populous township in Cape Town. I really wanted that to be one of the locations. I'd had a long fascination with the Akihahara suicide forest at the foot of Mount Fuji. So I thought, well, that would be a very interesting place to have another one of the plane crashes. I definitely knew I wanted one in the States, and I definitely knew I wanted one that would involve Europe. But I had absolutely no clue that to get all the details and get into the kind of cultural mindset and talk in the different voice and be able to speak in the different voices, the amount of research that it would take was, it was incredible and nonstop, and it completely did my head in. And I mean, there's a lot of research that I did that would never go anywhere near the novel. I mean, I had to, you know, the Japanese economic history, for example, books and books and books on that, because I had no clue about it before I started writing the book. And everything I was writing, even though this is a speculative fiction novel, it had to be in some way feasible. And I mean, you know, sure, it's highly unlikely that four planes would crash in one day, but it is actually, it could happen. It could actually happen. So, I mean, I did a lot of traveling. I spent some time in New York. I spent some time in Texas a few years ago. So I kind of had an idea of that sort of landscape, and, you know, I had quite a few Texan friends. And then I also went to visit Japan and actually went to the forest with my mom and walked around it in the snow completely alone, shitting myself. So yeah.
That actually jumps off to a slightly different point. You said that this was a speculative fiction novel, and as being a human being and wanting to classify things, I was trying to classify it as, yeah, is this science fiction? Is this horror? It's definitely got a tone of dread. It feels almost slightly alternate history, since you do set it slightly back in the past, so what makes it for you a speculative fiction novel, and why not write it more straight up? There are definitely speculative fiction elements that are very, very, very subtle that I don't think we should put a spoiler on yet, that only really come out in the denouement. So why include those elements at all? What do you think they bring to the story?
Well, I am at heart, I'm a horror writer. I would say that if anyone said, what kind of books do you write and what kind of writer do you want to be? I would say, well, I'm a horror writer. That is where my heart is. That's what I've grown up reading. That's what I love to read. That's what I love to write. So when I say speculative fiction, I suppose horror to me, like speculative fiction to me, is like a blanket sort of term, you know, like I certainly wouldn't say in anywhere near that the Three is a science fiction novel. There is some science in it, but it's not to that sort of the kind of standard that I would say that you'd have to achieve to get sort of science fiction status. But I think horror fits under the speculative fiction umbrella to a sense. But I find genre classification really difficult to do and really annoying as well, like labeling stuff, and so many books defy labels. Lauren Bukas and I often talk about it. I mean, how would you classify The Shining Girls? Is it a horror novel? Is it a science fiction novel? Is it a thriller? What
time
the hell
travel?
Is it? Yeah. What the hell? So it's I say speculative fiction, but I think if someone put a gun to my head, I would prefer The Three to be classified as a horror novel, but basically I write it. It's not up to me to classify it. It's up to people who read it.
Good point. Julie, I think you had your hand up next.
Yeah, so I'm just going to jump in on the classification of this particular book and say that from the very beginning, it definitely reads as a horror novel, and there is a question all throughout about whether or not the supernatural element is real, But the fact that there is a strong possibility of a supernatural element makes it, to me, clearly read as speculative as well. And then you add in the fact that it is slightly alternate history. And when you take into account small things in the world that are different, it's clear that the world has kind of been falling apart slightly in ways that it's not necessarily falling apart right now. And then, like, also that the Japanese scientist whose nephew is one of the survivors makes these androids that are basically exact copies of people who then can be their avatars, and he can speak through his, and his nephew can speak through his. That is very much science fiction. So I would say, for me, it's no question, this book is definitely firmly in speculative fiction territory, but I'd also firmly classify it as horror.
But, you know, it's not actually science fiction, because that guy is based on Hiroko Isoguro, who actually does make exact copies of androids for himself. He's actually made it several years ago. He's called the Android Man, and he works out of Osaka. And he made an exact copy of himself that's very much like in the book, that it is sort of motion capture technology. And it's so believable that what he does is, if he needs to go and lecture, like overseas, sometimes he'll send his android, and his android will speak through him, and he'll, you know, lecture to the students, saying, I don't know, Bolivia or whatever. He'll go and give a lecture on robotics, and this android he'll talk through his android. And the reason he does this is, it's not necessarily for the robotic side. It is to look at people's psychology. He wants to see how people will treat this very realistic looking android. And it doesn't take long for that uncanny valley to sort of break down, and they are sort of treating the sort of android as a human being. And I really wanted to get that across in the novel, because I had an interview with Rick Kleffel, and he actually brought this up, and I hadn't thought about it. And he said that there's a lot of imposters in the book. There's a lot, you know, the book is about imposters. And it didn't even occur to me that how prevalent it was. Throughout the novel, there's tons of instances of it. There's Paul, a character who is convinced that his niece is an exact copy of his niece. It's called cat, and that is an actual syndrome called Capgras syndrome, where you do start believing that, you know. Where does that come from? I don't know. I didn't consciously write that when I was writing the book. It's just a theme that came out, and I honestly believe it's from reading too much Philip K. Dick when I was a kid. I'm obsessed with what makes us human and what makes us,
Well, I was just going to jump on that. I think genre classification, I mostly just find it useful for pointing people to things that they're going to like based on not very useful, but at least the genre categories, they have like traditions. You know, science fiction is, some people would say, it's set in the future and it uses technology that doesn't currently exist. That's sci-fi. That obviously doesn't describe actual science fiction as a field. But it does describe at least a particular perspective on what that is, that can at least point people like, okay, that is going to be in that kind of category, and this will be in this other category. But in practical terms, I think it's fair to say that almost any work of literature is a mix of genres. I don't think there is anything that is a pure genre of anything, except maybe a Western. Maybe. No.
Yeah, maybe Western.
No, because most Westerns are like, they're, you know, thrillers, or they're romance stories, or like, so they mix up too. So I don't know if a Western really qualifies either. I think they're always going to be a mix. I think trying to split them up and say, this is just science fiction. No, it's a whole bunch of stuff. It's all kinds of things. It can be anything. Not saying this particular novel, but like, you know, some people might call this a horror novel. Others might call it, you know, maybe they'd call it science fiction, or maybe they would just call it maybe sort of like a creepy fantasy, a dark fantasy set in the present. Who knows? But it could be a thriller. It could be all kinds of things. But in any case, I did want to go back to the structure of the novel, because this is something that I found really fascinating, because we've already talked a little bit about the fact that you jump perspectives, because we have this overarching perspective of the individual who has written this fictional book – but then individual accounts within it of numerous types of people, people that are maybe family members or who were there after the plane crash. Maybe there's one, there's a section, for example, from the perspective of a paramedic who shows up and sort of the horrors that he saw, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So always different perspectives of people reacting to either the immediate moment or to later moments. And that's the thing that I want to talk about, is that this book is split into different sections, either dealing with conspiracy or survivors, et cetera, but they're in chronological order, taking place at different periods of time after or immediately during your opening chapter is actually during the plane crash. I was really interested in your desire to sort of structure this around these two, well, at least just for this perspective, two elements that kind of go back and forth in chronological order, survivors and conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera. What was kind of the impetus for structuring the novel in that particular fashion?
I think initially it was because, if I'm absolutely honest, it was because I got myself into an awful mess. It was, I knew what I wanted to say. I knew all my characters. I had the story. But to get this across and not make it an absolutely confusing mess, it needed some kind of structure there. So this to me was the most logical. So we get the, and I suppose in some a part of my brain, there was a kind of, well, this is the kind of the good people and these are the bad, you know, but of course it didn't end up like that because the conspiracy theorists are not necessarily the bad people and the survivors are not necessarily the good people. In fact, quite often they switch around, but, I thought that would be, it would make an sort of interesting sort of correlation. You could see how the kind of almost more human stories, for example, with Lillian Small, she has to become the carer of her grandson. And at the same time, she has a husband who's, got Alzheimer's. So it's a very, that her story is quite a human story. It's quite a close up story, a very personal story. And then on the other side with the conspiracy, there tends to be more sort of, I suppose, bigger sort of issues dealt with. Like, you know, what might be lurking in the kind of political landscape, what might be going on with how one of the conspiracists perhaps manages to collect so many followers, how it's possible for the sort of Japanese landscape to change as well. So that to me was, I suppose it was more of a contrast, but to be quite honest, it really was just a logical way in which I hoped that the reader would be able to follow the story. Because I make no mistake, I was very well aware that what I was doing was not going to appeal to everyone and that some people would find it an incredible pain in the ass to read. So, I really wanted to write it like this. And so I had to be as, you know, try and add as much clarity as I could to it. So, yeah.
I think one of the things for me that I found really fascinating about it was, when you were talking earlier about the fact that, when we get plane crashes, the way the media reports on it is, it's kind of insane in a way. For example, the most recent plane crash that you'd already mentioned.
Yeah.
I remember, I didn't watch it very closely, but I remember like anytime I tuned in a news station, they were talking about it and it would always be the most bizarre new information. It would never be like, okay, we found the plane, here's the facts that we know and that's the end of it. It was always like, well, maybe the plane was in a terrorist attack or maybe the plane was like abducted, but this is not happening, like abducted by aliens or just there's all these like conspiracy theories that the news was actually reporting. And I think the book, the way in which you sort of shift between all of these perspectives, despite the fact that there are obviously going to be those questions of authenticity based on the structure of the novel, it creates that same very disjointed feeling from what is the reality. Because I feel like as I was reading this, I don't feel like at any point I had like an aha moment. I know what's going on. It was always that sort of like, all I know is that planes crashed. That's it. And there was like some phone recorded messages. That was, I think, what was so enticing is this idea that even me as the reader, I am not being told all the information either, and I don't know what's real and what's not, and so I have to sort of try desperately to piece things together, but it doesn't matter what I do, whichever side I take, they're all horrific. None of them are fun. There's no puppies and flowers. It's all just really horrific different versions of a possible reality. And I don't know if that's something that you'd intended, but it certainly seems that based on some of the comments you'd already said about the way the media reports on either just plane crashes or any kind of sort of major disaster like that, it does seem like that was, if not unintentional, then maybe intentional.
Well, I think it's, I mean, part of the whole thing is that mystery, wasn't it? I mean, the mystery of the Malaysian air crash, it was, we didn't know what happened and we needed to get answers and we need answers. And I think that's the root of, like, you know, the biggest question of all, why the hell are we here? You know, I mean, that's why religions are formed. That's why cults are formed. That's why, that's what philosophy is about. So we need answers and we want answers. What I'm fascinated with, and of course the media helps feed this as well, is you've got a situation like the Malaysian air crash. There is a possible explanation for it that is, you know, fairly reasonable. Yet, people would rather go for the more outlandish explanation, you know, and that's what I tried to get across in the book. It's like, we know the causes of this crash is there, or do we? But there are some rational explanations that are there. But yet people would rather believe that the aliens are here and that they've taken over and will absolutely believe that. And, you know, that there are lizards kind of running the British government, which honestly, I think everyone does truly believe as well. But that you would go for these sort of strange and weird sort of out there explanations rather than choosing rationality. I mean, I love that. I really do. I mean, and I don't know the answer. Why would you rather believe that? And I was trying to explore that in the novel.
Interesting. Paul?
I think Julia had a hand up.
Was it Julia?
No, actually, Paul jumped in first, so go for it, Paul.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, that whole theme of rationality and irrationality is something I think, Sarah, that goes through the novel, and I wonder if you want to unpack that further, especially because you tread into some waters that I think an American speculative fiction author might not dare to do so, and that is the evangelistic Christianity. Why take that on? I mean, I could see having a Christian element to it, but you went straight for the gut and went for straight Texas, full octane evangelistic Christianity. Yeah. Why go there?
Because I hate myself and I want to get death threats, which I have got, by the way.
Holy no,
but quite seriously, it's to be honest. It's because it fitted the story initially, because I came up with the four air crashes, then there were the survivors, and it was the Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Well, that followed on quite naturally, and it was only, and it was actually fed by the time of, at the time by the, there was the 2012 sort of, thing going on in the States, and obviously you're aware of how much of an influence, you know, that the US elections have on, you know, throughout the world. I mean, especially Africa. And so I was watching this, obviously, and I was listening to all the pundits that were coming on. And obviously there was the whole thing about the Tea Party and the kind of anti-gay marriage rhetoric, and which obviously is, I find, quite terrifying. So that kind of fed into it as well. As far as the whole Texas evangelistic thing, I mean, I have to say, I was very aware that some of the characters I was creating were stereotypes, and that was a bit of a challenge. I mean, you've got the gay actor, you've got the Texan preacher, you've got the tart with a heart, you know, the prostitute, Lola Cando, who is, you know, she's working girl, but she's got a heart of gold, that kind of thing. So I really was going for that. And I wanted to see, can you make these people three-dimensional? Because they're usually two-dimensional. And I think in some cases, yeah, you can. In some cases, no. I don't think I managed to pull it off well enough. But I am aware that where I was treading on shark, I was treading on shark infested waters. I was swimming right into a very dangerous zone. But I don't see why I shouldn't. I don't think anything in fiction is not fair game. I don't think anything. Why should I stay away from something just because it's contentious? I mean, I'm not going to. It's I'm a storyteller. It's I don't think that this book, the primary reason I write it is because I write entertaining fiction and I want people to have a great page-turny read. But there is always a social critique element that does creep in all the novels, whether I like it or not. And what would happen if a very, very right-wing evangelical, president got into power who absolutely did believe that the rapture was coming. I mean, it's this belief that the rapture is, the people who do believe in it absolutely 100% believe in it. It is their way of life. And how that, I was interested in how that would affect society and how, especially, minority society. I think it would be terrifying and I think it would be dangerous. And I think that there's, so that was definitely part of it as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Paul.
Just a comment. I'm happy that New York State was considering secession by the end of the novel. That's my hometown. So yeah, it's like, thank God they want to get out. Fully for them. Go ahead, Julia.
I think that especially taking that far right, far fundamentalist Christian sort of sects are not necessarily as much of a sticky point as taking the mainstream Christian, because that's not the mainstream. That's the fringes. Those people were like living on a compound in rural Texas.
Yeah,
which...
but they didn't. The thing was that the because of what was happening and because of this message, it did actually start to the mainstream. And I think that's what people have an issue with, is that I can tell you this, at all the research I was doing, 3 o'clock in the morning, after reading up of the rapture, after reading all the Left Behind books, after reading the Bible several times, after reading countless sort of explanations about prophecy theory, I actually did say to myself, what if they are right? What if they are right? You know, it was so convincing. Some of them really are. And if you have if you're brought up with a modicum of belief as a sort of, at a certain level, I don't think it would take that much if you had proof to, and I think it all comes from fear. And
I definitely agree with that. I was just saying, I don't think it's as necessarily controversial to be writing a book where the characters who come up with that idea are from the fringes.
Yeah.
Than it would be to like directly attack all of mainstream culture.
Yeah.
And honestly, like even within that, you show the people as having multiple facets to their beliefs, systems and personalities and stuff. So I think there's a lot of room for exploration there. But my actual question was going to be about the creepy children, because we haven't really talked about creepy children. And you have some very sort of like, it's unclear whether the creepy children are actually creepy or not, but it seems pretty clear that they are really creepy, just based on the accounts that we have, even if they are curated accounts, like, there's some creepy, creepy stuff. So how did you decide to do that? And do you have like favorite creepy children that were influential? What did you want to do to walk that line to make it unclear whether they were creepy or not? And how well do you think you succeeded in what you intended to do?
I'm a massive fan of creepy children. I think all children are a bit creepy because they're so honest and their imaginations are like, I mean, some of the things that my daughter used to say to me when she was like 4 or 5 would just absolutely scare the shit out of you. Like the kind of, and I've heard sort of Lauren's daughter as well, just coming out with some absolute corkers. The thing about children is we're supposed to like sort of nurture them and they are the future. They are our future. Children are. And, then when there's something sort of not maybe demonic, but just like twisted about them, it kind of makes it worse because they're supposed to be so innocent and, you know, we're supposed to love them all and nurture them all. And then, so I think it ups the horror factor. But, well, and I mean, I've been watching creepy children movies since I was a small child because I had, you know, I was allowed to watch whatever I wanted. So I did grow up with things like the Midwich Cuckoos and the and the original Damien films, which I absolutely loved. And I mean, I was I was you know, way younger than a teenager when I was watching this. It made it clearly made a massive impression on me. And I think it was that kind of thing. It's like there's it's that innocence sort of corrupted, but in a sort of, you know, a really chillingly malevolent way that, where the children know what they're doing. You know, it's not just sort of, it just gives me the creeps just thinking about it. I don't know if I made them creepy enough, to be honest. I had great fun doing some of it, but, I found the kind of Lillian Small's grandson creepiest of them all, even though he was really, really sweet and sort of like never actually, you know, he didn't jump out of a closet or anything wearing a mask. But the fact that he was so unbelievably sweet to me was really, really wrong because children generally aren't sweet all the time. And weirdly, no one's kind of said anything about that, which is great, I suppose. But I think the world does need more creepy children. You can never have enough.
Oh man, that's great. This is going to be the thing you're known for. You're a creepy child aficionado, which you'll be remembered as. Just teasing. Oh my god, I just lost what I was going to say. And it was going to be about the creepy children. But now I lost it now. I'm sorry. Totally lost it.
I got a very interesting question from, like, I think it was a blogger who was in Poland, because apparently the readers in Poland really like this book, and I think they really like it because of the creepy children probably more than anything. For some reason, that's the feedback I'm getting, which is great. But, and they asked, why does Elspeth never actually talk to the children, you know, at first hand? Well, part of that is a plot issue, which I won't go into, but also because I do think that I've always thought that like the monster that's off the screen is scarier than the one you see coming out of the closet and you can see the fangs and the eyes and, you know, it's that kind of unknown. You know, I like that the children are creepy because you don't really know, are they that creepy? You know, are they aliens? Are they the horsemen of the apocalypse, or are they just kids who are absolutely messed up because of what they've been through? Do they just have severe PTSD, and that's kind of making their personalities a bit warped? I suppose that's where the creepiness factor comes from more than anything in the novel.
I was actually going to ask that, and you half answered it. The choice of only going to their caretakers and guardians rather than actually going to the children, it goes into something I was thinking of before. Do you think having Elspeth as the basically telling her story through this meta device and being a tabloid journalist, do you think that sort of elides the stereotypes that do crop up in the novel? Basically, because we're seeing all these characters through a tabloid journalist's perspective and her writing. Oh, you're basically writing it through her eyes, and that's why they come out the way they are. And we only see the children through these guardians because that's the way the journalist is filtering all this. So they look sweet, but we're basically seeing it at three removes, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was part of it. And that was a real bugger to do as well, because there's things like for example, in the Japanese characters sections where they're messaging each other. And, I had to be aware that I was writing something that would then be kind of messed with, Americanized, translated, and then Elspeth would mess with as well. So to get that across and still bring the personality of the sort of narrators across as well was a really fine line, and there is actually quite a lot of material that had to get chopped out of the book because it really didn't work at all as far as that was concerned. But it's also one of the things I really wanted to comment on as well with the whole book within a book thing was the effect the book has towards the end of the novel. I'll try not to do any spoilery things, but it does have quite a profound effect on politically what's happening, this book that this tabloid journalist has written. And I think that if you want to go speculative fiction, that is probably the most outlandish thing in the whole novel, really, is the fact that literature could have such a profound effect on society. And that is just pure wishful thinking in my part, I think. I was just like, I would love the idea that someone could write a book that would influence people in such a way. And then, of course, obviously, they have, which has influenced the last 2,000 years. So, yeah, getting myself in knots a bit. But, yeah, I did. That did interest me to have, to see the power of sort of literature and how it could change us as well.
Oh, Julia, you got a hand. Go ahead.
So I'm wondering, you tend to write a lot of horror generally based on what I've seen of your internet profiles. This is the first thing I've ever read from you. I'm wondering what in particular draws you to horror, and also what to you is the scariest part of this book?
The scariest part was actually writing it and then doing all the publicity. No, it was the scariest part of the book was, writing the beginning, which was the plane going down. And I wrote that in one go, very intensely. And, I really had to think very carefully and put myself in the position of what it would actually be like to be on a plane that was crashing. I mean, like what it would smell like, what it would sound like, how the other people would react. And I'd been on a plane sort of, I think it was 1995, but that had fallen kind of out of the air. It had just like dropped, and it was absolutely terrifying. But on the plane I was on, nobody panicked at all. No one panicked. It was just silence. And that was weird. And like, people don't ever react to how you think they're going to react. I mean, you'd think everyone would be like screaming and everything. I mean, after that, almost everyone on the plane threw up, but they didn't scream or shout or panic or anything. So I had to think about that kind of thing. And writing that scene gave me nightmares for 2 weeks, and I could not sleep without, sleep aids for 2 weeks after that, because I really, really scared myself. And why I write horror, I like feeling fear, but I like only like feeling real, safe fear, which is the kind of fear you get in fiction, because you know that these things don't exist. I like the kind of thrill of it, and it's from being, you know, sort of growing up with it. Like a sort of the same kind of fear when you're on an amusement park ride. You know it's going to be over, and you know it's not real, and you know that the roller coaster isn't actually going to crash into the ground, even if it feels like it. I like that sort of sensation, but I've also experienced real fear and real pure fear, and it is nothing like the other kind, and that I wouldn't wish on anyone. But safe fear is pleasurable,
even if you need a sleep aid for 2 weeks after writing one scene.
Yep.
Yeah, but I remember I'm writing the books. I'm not actually reading them.
Yeah, I will just say, like, right now that so I've been alone in my house for the last week because my fiance has been off at a conference on the other side of the country. So right now he's in the air. Hopefully he'll not be in a plane crash and everything will be well. And if he is, I'll blame you. But like every night this week and pretty much most nights since I read this book, and this is one of those things which is why I kind of like, I'm very careful with horror. Like I was very careful to read this book and finish it well before he left so I would have time to adjust, because I know horror affects me and I will get nightmares and stuff. I have woken up in the 3 o'clock hour every single night.
Oh,
every single night. And there's this thing in the book, which I think this actually happens in a lot of different horror things, because it's in the Amityville Horror. There's significance around 3:15 being a time that like the people keep waking up at that time. And in the three, you mentioned that like 3 o'clock is the Japanese witching hour, which I don't know if that's true or not, but like the seed is planted. So I wake up at 3 a.m. now. Thanks.
Sorry, I'm really sorry. It's also the most common time for people to break into your houses as well. But you probably didn't need to hear that either.
Yeah, no. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Yeah, no, I wake up at 3 a.m. and I'm like, fine, I'm going to have to stay awake until 4 now.
I'm so sorry, Julia, really, I am. But there is that kind of, do you know that's when I get the most work done? It's like from 2 a.m. till 4 a.m. I get about pretty much the same amount of work done, writing done, as I do if I work the whole day. And I think it's because it's just something weird about that time. It's just, I think the whole, you know, because you know the world or the country or the hemisphere you're in is sleeping. And it's just this sort of perfect time, but it's also perfectly creepy and still.
So is it actually the Japanese witching hour? Is that a thing?
Yes, it is. It is. It is. I think it's called the Itsu Mushu or something like that. But yeah, it is 3 o'clock. I think 3 o'clock pretty much the witching hour for everywhere, isn't it?
I think it's certainly a time when I would be likely to wake up anyway, because I tend to have my sleep pattern, and I think that this is probably true for a lot of people. I tend to sleep in a couple of large blocks, and usually I'll wake up for a little while in the middle of the night, and sometimes I can go right back to sleep, and other times I get up for a while and I do some work, and then I go back to sleep, and a lot of times it's between 2 and 4 that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, we're being told something, I think. Yeah.
I just want everybody to know that I am getting on a plane on Wednesday.
Oh, no.
Coming to Minnesota.
And my brother will be flying from Oregon. So, thanks, guys.
Well, I'm not getting on a plane myself until I go to London for WorldCon in August. So we'll look forward to that one.
Yeah, see, I'm not too worried about that, because if we crash in the water, I can swim.
I have to say that no. But the thing I'm actually the most afraid about for that one is my legs swelling up. So I bought some compression socks today.
they do, those work. But I just want to say, just sit towards the rear of the aircraft. You have a better chance, statistically.
I'm just saying. That.
And if you crash in the sea, you can pretty much forget it. Because
yeah, I was just gonna say, like, I don't think sitting towards the rear of the aircraft is gonna help in my transatlantic flight. Like, if the plane goes down, we're done.
You'll be fine if it crashes on takeoff or landing. That's where you want to be. I'm just saying. And that's the most, you know, that's when it's probably going to crash if it is.
This is so just not the fun conversation. Let's talk about puppies.
There are no happy puppies in this book, Sean. Did you read the same book as we did?
There is one happy puppy, though. Snooki is a very happy puppy. Well looked after.
There are also monitor lizards.
Oh, God.
I love that scene.
Oh, God.
That makes me so happy that you put that in there, because that actually happens.
I know. I'm aware.
Yeah, I did. I don't know where I read about it. I think it was a New Yorker article or something about the guy who got eaten alive by his own pets, which, it did. Oh, yeah.
It's happened a few times that I can remember seeing articles about. So it's one of those things. There was a guy in Germany who got eaten by all of his pet spiders and lizards and things a while ago.
Yeah, I just think there's a tarantula living in your, burrowing into your chest. It's like, that is my worst nightmare. Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty horrifying. That's like some crap out of Alien. Ugh.
Yeah,
but it does happen, and I did think it was really amusing, because this is the chapter with the paparazzi guy who tries to sneak photos with one of the creepy children. And based on the account from his neighbor, it comes back from this adventure in which he like does this undercover operation and everything, which is just hilarious, a paparazzi guy doing this, and then discovers him eaten partially by his monitor lizards, having presumably killed himself from an insulin overdose. So I'm not ruining anything, because it's only like one chapter out of like 8,000, so you'll be good. But
out of 8,000, I like the way you say that.
Well, it's not quite that many, but yeah, you know, I don't want to make anybody like that this is like a big reveal. It's like it's one chapter. And I really love that scene, and I think even though it's kind of horrifying when you think about it, but I love it because it's something that is real, and it happens a lot, where people get eaten alive by their pets, and it happens even more with monitor lizards. I say more just in terms of the percentage of people who do stupid things with their animals that are monitor lizards, because people will do this. They'll buy these, like, 6 foot, well, they grow to 6 feet, they're like 6 foot enormous Nile monitors, and then let them wander around the house like a dog. And it's like, no, it's not a dog. It is a giant lizard, and it'll bite your freaking leg off. I love those where you insert these, I guess, like, realistic, factual things into the sort of weirdness that's going on, because I think it does offer a kind of grounding. And for me, because I'm obsessed with reptiles, so that helped. I mostly ignored the spiders part, because spiders are creepy.
Yeah, spiders are... I mean, obviously in Cape Town, they grow to the size of buses, like spiders. So we try not to think about them too much.
Well, thank you. I won't be ever visiting.
No. But, my daughter had a snake once called Fluffy the Trouser Snake. And he was a puff adder. Not a puff adder, a ball adder. And we woke up one morning and he'd actually exploded because his heating pad had malfunctioned, and it was so sad. You just to wake up to this reptile that had just exploded on his what do you call it, the cage, not a cage,
terrarium.
Thank you. So yeah, I'm also quite obsessed with reptiles as well. I love them. I think they're beautiful and fascinating, but I would never have one as a pet again.
That's so sad about Puffy the Trouser Snake.
Yes, it was. It was very sad.
So you said it was a ball adder?
Yeah.
Is that a ball python? Is that what we call it?
A ball python. Sorry. We have puff adders here in Cape Town, which are, I think they're our most feared snake, because they will bite you and basically your arm will fall off. It'll turn kind of all puffy and gangrenous and then it'll just drop off. So they're always on my mind. But yeah, it was a ball python.
Okay.
So basically what you're telling me is that Cape Town is in competition with Australia for a place that most wants to kill you.
Yes. I'm not even going to start on the people.
Actually, that dovetails into actually my question. Going back to South Africa, I was thinking about this when we talked about crashing in the ocean. One of the more visceral and interesting scenes for me, because aside from something like, No offense, District 9, it was sort of an alien concept, was that slum in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And I recall you saying on our earlier podcast, which all the listeners should listen to, about literature in South Africa being a political thing. Is that why you said that plane crash in that, I can't pronounce it, begins with a K?
Khayelitsha.
Khayelitsha. Is that why you set that crash there specifically? Why did you have a crash in your own backyard, not so great part of your own backyard, as it were. I thought you could speak to that.
I think it's not, because part of it was I knew that this was going to be a global book. I did not necessarily know if anyone would read it, but I certainly wanted Africa to be represented, and not just the kind of sort of Africa that is stereotyped with the lions and the kind of game parks and everything. I mean, this is how the majority of people in South Africa live. By far the majority. And it seemed like that this was some way in a kind of, obviously on a very surface level, that I could show this and comment on it. I mean, there are like accounts from refugees. Khayelitsha is home to thousands upon thousands of refugees from all over Africa. I suppose, I mean, it's also because I'm very familiar with it. And I wouldn't say it was laziness, but I mean, certainly, I went out of my comfort zone on an awful lot of this book. I mean, I would say probably about 80% of it was way out of my comfort zone. So, having Khayelitsha in it was quite comforting for me, actually, even though some pretty awful things happened there in the book. It was familiar grounding. I didn't have to research it, for 6 months. So that was part of it as well. Whether I was, I've tried to look back over after we had the last podcast discussion about political sort of inferences in writing. And I think Lauren was dead right. I think there is there are very few books that don't in some way comment on, well, very few good books that don't in some way comment on some kind of sort of social or political issue.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly address some of, I mean, even that section that Paul's talking about, I appreciated that there you're sort of referencing a number of aspects of this particular area without like sort of delving into its history, because it wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for the style. But you present, for example, some of the violence that occurs there just by sort of passively mentioning it through the characters. For example, this act using, I believe it's you use a tire and
oh, yeah.
on fire.
Necklacing. Yeah.
Yeah, necklacing.
Yeah.
That's sort of mentioned offhand as this paramedic is sort of telling his story of when he went to this plane crash and what he had seen there. And so you get this without sort of like really delving into the issues, because it again what's happening here is he's going to this plane crash. You sort of present the sort of the field, the landscape, the politics and the concerns that are here without having to actually like delve into it. I don't know how well American audiences will pick up on, for example, the necklacing, but it was something that I've been familiar with, and that's because Lauren Bucus's Zoo City, I believe, mentions it a couple times.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's very interesting how you do that. So,
thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, it is the violence in South Africa is – it is, we do almost, it is because it's such a way of life that it would, you know, that sort of that dropping in a fact like that would not be unusual. I mean, nobody, I don't know anyone who hasn't experienced violence. I don't know in South Africa or hasn't had a family member experience it, whatever demographic where they're from. And, so it is, and if the character were to pick up on it and really go into depth with it, it would be out of character for him, especially for a paramedic who is used to sort of all the paramedics I know who, especially who have to go into do a lot of work in the townships, see unbelievable things and highly traumatic things and you know, incredible levels of violence. So to him, that would be, you know, a sort of a comparison like of the plane crash really was unprecedented in its horror. And if you're South African, I think you will pick up on that to really get the scale of just how horrible it was, that it kind of in comparison to the other stuff he's seen. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is something that you do really well. I mean, not just for the South Africa, but for many of the chapters that take place in other places. I mean, for example, I'll just talk about the ones that I can actually comment on because I live in this country. You know, I know we had talked earlier about this idea that there are stereotypes in here of certain types of people. And yet, I believe his name is Len Voorhees.
Yes. Yeah.
By the way, is that a reference to Friday the 13th?
Yes, of course. Of course.
Wow.
I also wondered that.
Yeah.
Because I saw Voorhees and I was like, this guy's going to be the killer. He's going to be like the grand designer. He's going to have turned all these creepy children into creepy children. And like, he's going to be Satan. That's not necessarily how it goes. Or is it? No, I'm just kidding. But for example, his character, one of the... from an American perspective, the evangelical characters are like, these are things that we've seen in the news. They appear. We have politicians that talk kind of like this guy. So it's not exactly out of character. It may seem like a stereotype, but this sort of occurs. But one of the interesting things I love that you did with this character was, when you told the story of his, interactions with a prostitute.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have used that word. She would have used, I forget the term she would have used. It would not have been prostitute. I guess like companion. But she uses another term. But in any case, but that's essentially what she is. And he's this pastor, and he is visiting her sort of to talk about, I guess, his worries. And obviously he's going for sex. And I appreciated you sort of taking that moment to talk about this, because this is actually something that does actually occur, where there have been a number of sort of scandals of these just very, very politically, I'll say politically or religiously extreme individuals who have particular things to say about sexuality. And then, of course, what ends up happening is, in some cases, we discover that, well, but they are probably talking about themselves as much as they are talking about other people, because they're, of course, engaging in these things. And yet this also, I think, humanizes his character. It takes away this idea that he is just this person that only certain people will ever agree with, and a very small portion. It actually makes him somewhat more, I feel, at least to me, more human, more someone I can connect with, because I'm not that, I'm not in that particular religious persuasion. So for me, it sounds very cuckoo. But we get sort of that inner perspective of him, at least a little bit. So, and it felt authentic to me, but.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's human nature. It's like you, I think that's a problem with a lot of, very stringent sort of, you know, if you put, like, for example, Catholicism, just for an example, I'm not knocking anything here, but it's, you know, that, If you're trying to curtail someone's sort of sexuality, or you're trying to put very stringent rules that don't necessarily correlate with human nature, you're going to have problems, and you're going to have people who are basically being acting in a hypocritical way. Mm-hmm. And that was part of it. And it's also because he's I did want people to question, well, exactly how religious and moral is he, you know, if he can do this and live with himself when he's preaching to everyone else that it's immoral, and how much about what he's doing in his faith is to do with wanting to be important and wanting to be powerful, you know, because and control other people. I think that's a big motivating factor for him as well.
Yeah. It's certainly a big concern right now, I think, within certain religious communities. I mean, you've already brought up the Catholic Church, and I don't want to say anything against all Catholics to say Catholics are bad
people.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. But obviously currently there are a number of issues going on in the Catholic Church with child abuse and molestation. And I think you're right that there is an aspect of that as human nature. And I think it would be easy to sort of discard that, maybe to make people feel comfortable, or, well, maybe that's not the reason you would do it, but to sort of ignore it. Like, but this is actually part of this, you know, not all evangelical preachers are actually living by the words they speak. And that should tell us something about the human condition by actually exploring these people who are flawed, that are not, you know, these sort of saintly beings. They're people. They do people things, I guess is the way I'm going to say it. I think it's a really effective point, and I do think, as I said, it sort of humanizes him, makes him more than just sort of a mouthpiece for a religious view. It makes him sort of, it gives us some sense of his motivations and desires, I think. So
thank you.
Yeah. Julia, you had a hand, so I'll jump to you.
Yeah, so this actually reminds me that back in the 90s when I was in college, one of the jobs that I had to pay my rent and support myself through college was, for a while I was working doing data entry, scraping the internet to help a local search engine company that was trying to get the conceit behind the company was that you would type in like your local town and get all of the businesses that were in your town and all of the stuff that was related to where you lived. So it was like bringing the internet to a very localized sort of level. And so what I would do is like go through all the search engines that we could find, which at the time, you know, this was the late 90s and it was before Google had dominated everything. So like we would spend all of our work shifts going through Lycos and Yahoo and Dogpile and all of those and Google because it was in its fledgling stage. And basically we'd type in town names and zip codes that we'd be assigned certain towns and certain zip codes, and we would look for any websites that were registered in that town. And doing this, I would find, like, this was all supposed to be very family friendly, so we would not put any porn, you know, anything like that. It was very much like above board. This is a thing that you could be doing at your house with your children and your grandma and nobody would be offended. But we found a lot of porn sites because it's the internet. But one of the sites that I found that was the most fascinating was a website by a woman who worked as a prostitute specifically for the clergy. And she had this whole thing, including Bible quotes and all sorts of justifications using ancient texts and things that it was perfectly okay for members of the clergy to take lovers and that, like, you know, they weren't supposed to marry and it wasn't supposed to distract them from their holy calling, but also they had needs and there were historically women who provided for those needs. And she was a very good Christian woman and she was only interested in taking members of the clergy who were very good Christian men who understood what she was doing and not interested in anyone else. But, like, if you were that, call her.
Ah.
And what? I've never forgotten that website. There are many porn sites that I have totally forgotten, but that one I have never forgotten because it's just, it speaks to this kind of culture that says, you know, you have to live by certain constricting rules, but then how do you bend those? How do you twist it to make it okay for you to do the things that you want to do? And how to, because doing something like that, it's like doing a very strict crash diet. You know, how long can you maintain it? For a few days, sure, forever, I don't know. Everybody has base urges. When do you give in?
Wow.
Wow, that was...
deep.
So I thought of that when I was reading this book, because I was reading the account of the prostitute who was talking about her relationship with Pastor Lynn, and I was thinking, you know, she sounds... not entirely, but a lot like this woman who was like, no, I'm only going to do this with upstanding clergy members.
I feel terrible. I didn't know about this, and I could have put it in the book. I'm going to hire you, Julia, to do my research.
It is kind of in the book, though. I mean, there is that moment when she talks about her choice in clientele. I mean, it's obviously not as specific as what Julia was saying, but she says that some of the people she knows who do this, they, of course, serve, I guess is the term she uses, special needs, people who have desires like anybody else, but of course they have conditions which are not quote unquote appealing to the general public. And so these people basically provide a service for them. They provide companionship and sex and that kind of thing. She obviously says she does not participate in that. She's chosen a different path, but it is sort of indicated to some extent that, you know, she's a little bit more particular in what she, in the clientele she will take. Granted, it's just not as specific as what Julia was suggesting, but it is very, I just like those chapters. I don't know why.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, I mean, I don't see, I mean, that's one of the things that what I did want to say about her was that she, especially having a lot of like sort of differently abled sort of clients or whatever. I mean, that's something when everyone's on their high horse about we need to, make prostitution illegal and it needs to be banned and everything. I mean, there's a lot of people that for whom this service is, it can be life saving, it can be life changing. So it's not, you know. But I'm still like kind of miffed that I hadn't heard about that website. I would have made it far more overt.
I kind of like it that it wasn't, because I think that the way I read Pastor Lynn's character is a lot like you were talking about, where, you know, how much of his faith is faith and how much of it is him wanting to have power. And when you think about it that way, like, he wouldn't want to do anything that could trace him back to,
yeah,
to this prostitute. So, like, even if there was a website for members of the clergy doing this, like, he probably wouldn't use that one. Maybe it would have given him the idea that he could look for a different prostitute, but he's not going to use one that has a website.
I really like the way you think. Thank you, Judith.
I just want to comment. I found him an almost a tragic figure in a way. I don't know if you were intending to do that, Sarah.
Yeah, totally. Thank you.
It's just like... He wants power. He wants all this for his church. He gets it. He grabs the tiger and then he gets it taken away from him and it goes national and he's left behind his vision and his dreams shattered and broken. I'm not a giant fan of evangelistic Christianity, but I felt sorry for him.
Yes, good. I'm so glad. Thank you. Cause so did I. I did too, and I'm really glad that you did. It was that was quite important. I don't necessarily see him as a baddie at all. Mm-hmm. I see him as someone who's just damaged and just, you know, he hasn't got his dreams. He hasn't got his life how he wanted his life. He's riddled with disappointment, and I mean, he's not a good man by any stretch of the imagination. But I in no way would I ever say that Pastor Len was evil. And I do agree with you. He is absolutely tragic. And thank you.
Welcome.
I feel like there's a lot of that throughout the novel of people who die or take their own lives. there is sort of a tragic aspect to all of their life. I mean, even the paparazzi guy, I mean, the way in which he does die in the end is, you know, there's the hint in that particular chapter that it's, he has possibly been influenced somehow by one of the creepy children. Although that's never confirmed, because the only time we hear about the creepy children having anything weird happen to them is through other people's accounts, not any sort of like firsthand evidence or anything of that nature. It's always sort of like a guy goes into a room to say hello to the Ace, for example, goes into the room and he wants to interview the child, and he has this creepy moment where the child's eyes start bleeding, but he's the only one that saw it. And so he can't confirm it. It's only what he believes he saw. And the same, even though we don't hear exactly what happens, the same thing with the paparazzi guy. You know, he goes and he goes through this whole process to get to this kid. Then he claims he didn't see the kid, but of course there are pictures that were leaked that said he did. And then he gets home and he's just not the same person anymore. And then he sort of dies in this gruesome, horrific way. But it is very tragic, I feel. You know, because this is, even though I don't think he's a good person based on the extent to which he will go to succeed at getting his pictures, he still is remarkably good at what he does and is providing at least a service for people. And it's sort of horrific that that's the thing that kills him, destroys him in a way. Yeah.
I agree with you, but I'm reluctant to talk more about this because I don't really want to spoil the book. And I feel like we've talked a lot about stuff that actually does spoil some of it.
We only talked about two parts.
Yeah,
but let's not talk about anybody
else. But you've now basically like talked a lot about a lot of the American part of the book. And like one of the things that I've stayed away from is talking too much about the Japanese part, because I thought that was really interesting. And like speaking of imposters and the different ways that you play with imposter sort of mentalities and perceptions, there's a lot of that within the Japanese section of the book. But I don't want to go into any of it because I don't want to spoil that for people who are coming to read it.
Cool. No, I agree. I think I've had some really interesting reactions to that section as well. Like, it's very much one of the sort of love for hate reactions. Like, people either love it or they absolutely hate it and want me to die. So it's been interesting.
That actually leads to a question. Since this book is going international and seems to be doing very well internationally, I was just curious what different parts of the book different readers have reacted to you about. And does it match up with the geography, or is there any particular sections or areas of the book that are getting much more interest from your readers? How is that reader-author relationship going, especially on an international sort of framework?
I found that from being in like publishing in South Africa for so many years, and I found the South African readers incredibly enthusiastic, which may sound like you wouldn't expect, but is quite an unusual experience for me, actually, because I don't tend to do very well, especially with the horror books in South Africa, the S.L. Grey horror books. So that's been great. Polish readers have been incredibly enthusiastic, amazing actually, and same with Brazilian readers, just like wanting to talk in depth about the concepts. Same, I mean, it's all over. I think the majority of the people that have really been pissed off with the book and have really thrown it across the room and have been probably, I would say, from the States rather than Europe, which I kind of expected. It makes me a bit sad, but it's still, I knew that it was going to be a contentious novel when I finished writing it, so.
Well, you've got three Americans here who liked it.
Oh, thank you. You see, I was waiting, I was fishing for that, did you hear?
So out of curiosity, just like to boil this down for people listening and trying to decide whether or not this is a book for them, like, what have the general reactions of both love and hate pointed to?
Oh, well, okay, the ending's the big one. Like, people have very strong opinions on this, and it is a love-hate opinion. I can't tell you what it is because that's massive spoiler. The one that's least spoken about, the part that's least spoken about is actually the Japanese section. And also the section set in Kyalicha as well. I don't know why. I don't know why that's very rarely comes up on, you know, that people have asked me stuff about. But and obviously the fact that there's religion and there's kind of like there is an inference that several of the characters are pro gun control is quite prevalent in the book, and so I've got quite a lot of stuff about that. Even though it's hardly mentioned in the novel, it still seems to be a hot topic that people pick up on.
That's interesting.
Interesting. Well, I will say that the Japanese section really intrigued me, and I haven't talked about it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone. But like one of the things that I liked about it was that it in the same way that the rest of the novel does this with pretty much everyone, there is the central character who is the narrator of the Japanese part that you see most of her chat logs. There's a lot of question about who is she? Is she who she says she is? Is she someone different? And who does she even say she is? Mm. And that kind of the different layers of how a person can present themselves and what that means are there throughout the entire book with everyone. I mean, you mentioned it with Paul, the actor. And then there's Pastor Len, and pretty much all of the book takes a look at how this disaster affects people and who they say they are versus who their actions and thoughts reveal them to be.
Mm. And how they are online and how they are
in person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, even to the point of the writer of the tabloid book, which makes up the large portion of the book itself, like most of the book is the book within the book. Yes. And a lot of it is even her, like who she thinks she is starting out, who she presents herself as in this book, and who she ends up deciding she is at the end. So I think we've probably gotten to the point, though, where we should wrap up. And if we talk more, like, we will totally spoil the book for people. And I think I will say, if you like horror fiction, this is worth a read. If you like things that have lots of twists and turns and look at things from lots of different angles, this is good. And also, if you're a fan of Max Brooks and Stephen King and sort of, like, thinky horror in general, that you would probably enjoy this book.
Yeah.
Seconded.
Yeah, I would say if you don't like any horror whatsoever, maybe not a good choice, but if you like horror, this would be a good choice. And even if you're not a big horror reader, but you sort of kind of like creepy things, this would be good too. Because I wouldn't say this is quite, I wouldn't say it's like The Exorcist where like heads, like every 3 seconds, like the kid's doing creepy crab walking downstairs.
I will say it starts out with a really, like, when Sarah said that this was the hardest scene to write was the first scene, and the first scene was to me like absolutely the most harrowing. So it starts out with a major bang, and if you are afraid of flying and you know that this will give you nightmares, probably don't take this book on a plane.
I wasn't going to say, but I was wondering, are you going to sell any of this book in an airport bookstore? I'm not sure I would want to read this on a flight to London or anywhere else. No offense, Sarah, but...
No, none taken. It's a compliment. I don't know if they will. You know, like, that they couldn't show flight on aeroplanes? And it was weird because, like, when I had to speak to a whole bunch of people about the doing, like, a film or TV version of the book. And it was very interesting talking to them because that was one of their concerns. Oh, you know that this will never, that if we make this thing, it will never be shown on planes. I didn't know that they couldn't, that you weren't allowed to show plane crash things on airplanes. I mean, it makes sense. So whether they'll ban it from airports, I don't know. It'd be awesome if they did.
Oh, I'm waiting. I just really hope, there's a sick part of me kind of hopes that we get lots of like really angry customers who were reading the book while they're on a plane. But they're not mad at you. They're mad at the people that decided to stock it in an airport.
Or like, better if they bought it from Amazon.
All right. Well, okay. So we should wrap this up by asking our last couple quick questions. The first will be, I mean, obviously this is fairly recent book. It came out, was it March in the States?
May.
May. Okay. So what can people expect from you in terms of your writing in the, let's say, in the near future, if you're maybe working on something you are allowed to talk about? And if not that, then, you got any convention appearances in the next few months that you would like to mention, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm nearly done. I'm two days away from finishing the, it's kind of a sequel to the three, but isn't a sequel, which is all I can say. And it's set on a cruise ship.
Oh my.
Yeah, it is kind of, I'm going through all the, I'm destroying transport, I think. I don't know. Maybe there'll be a train next. Maybe a car, a haunted bicycle, who can say. But it is like the next one. And then Paul's just written, Sarah Lott's destroying transport options. That's awesome. So,
I just have to interrupt you here to say, this reminds me of, the Universal Studios tour in Hollywood, which my cousin worked as a tour guide there for a little while. So I helped him memorize the script and I know it all. And one of the things that they talk about is that one of the things on the back lot is the house that they used in Psycho.
Yeah.
And so one of the stories that they tell is that an angry fan had written a letter to Alfred Hitchcock saying, I took my daughter to see this movie. My daughter had seen this French movie where someone got killed in a bathtub. And then I took her to see Psycho where someone gets killed in a shower. And now she won't take baths or showers. So what am I supposed to do about this? And Alfred Hitchcock is sort of like, it's not my fault. But yeah, you're destroying transportation the same way that Alfred Hitchcock has ruined, apparently, bathing.
But think of the environment. I mean, people won't get on planes. They won't get on cruise ships. I'll save how many trees and bunnies will I save? So I think I'm doing good in a sense there. But the cruise ship book was a tricksy one to write, but I'm not actually allowed to say anything more about it. I am, but I'm not going to. And then I'll be in, I'll see you guys at, LondonCon in August.
Yes!
Hurrah! And I will be buying you all very many pints to say thank you for being so amazing and for inviting me onto your brilliant, brilliant,
Hugo-nominated podcast twice.
It is! It's Hugo-nominated. And yep. Quite rightly so.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm preparing my acceptance speech now to be 25 minutes long.
No, I will just cut you off. I'll bring a hooked cane and I will pull you off the stage.
Oh, you should totally do that. We could stage that. That would be adorable. And then we get nominated for short form next year.
No, again, I'm going to veto that idea.
Any case, I'm sorry, Sarah. So you'll be at LondonCon. Is there any other events that you may be attending?
Nine Worlds as well, which is also in August, which is a big geek fest. So I'll be doing that. That's in London as well. Well, it's run by the Porno Kitschy crowd. So anything they touch is amazing. So really can't wait. Otherwise, there's a couple of things in September. But I can't remember what they are.
Fair enough. I guess the last thing is just, where can people find you on the interwebs in case they don't already know?
I'm on Twitter sometimes and it's Sarah Lott's and then one. I'm generally, if I'm not full on in writing mode, I'm quite happy to mess about and chat to anyone I've had some hilarious conversations on Twitter, but when I'm in writing mode, I tend to be a bit of a curmudgeon and don't come out of my sort of self-imposed exile for a while. So if I'm ever ignoring anyone on Twitter, I'm really not ignoring you. I will actually reply to you. Does that sound paranoid? Yeah.
No, not at all. Perfect. Well, everybody should go check out the three. You should, by check out, I mean buy 8 copies, every single person in the United States. because I'm sure that would really help Sarah's career if she sold 310 times 8, a lot of copies. Yeah, you'd also have sold more copies, I think, than any other book, so that would be great.
Amazing. Thank you.
You're welcome. So go check that out, and obviously thank you very much, Sarah, for coming on again and spending time with us and talking about your book.
Thank you. It was brilliant. I really appreciate it. You're all amazing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, and obviously thank you, Julia, for being my co-ninja host. I'm sorry, you don't want – not ninjas.
Yep.
just co-host.
I'll accept that.
Thank you, Julia.
It was my pleasure.
And obviously, thank you, Paul, as well.
Oh, I don't get ninja. What do I get? Cyber Knight, maybe?
You can be a knight.
There we go, Cyber Knight.
You're a prince.
Yes, he is a prince. He's Prince Justin.
There we go. There we go. All right, and on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.